Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's address on Afghanistan tomorrow, where he's expected to announce the withdrawal of 10,000 troops from a war the American people increasingly see as a lost cause. The former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who also served as CIA station chief in Kabul, Graham Fuller, joins us. Then we will speak with Professor of Law at the University of Chicago, Aziz Huq, who wrote an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Defend Muslims, Defend America. We will discuss the racist paranoia behind the ludicrous rash of bills in state legislatures banning Sharia law, following the lead of Oklahoma. In addition to the obvious insult to America's core values and a violation of the First Amendment, we'll examine the consequences of these discriminatory laws in terms of their adverse effect on our national security. Then, with two Nebraska nuclear plants threatened by the rising floodwaters of the Missouri River, we will look into nuclear safety in the United States following the recent disasters in Japan and an expose by the AP accusing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of weakening safety rules to keep America's aging reactors operating. The president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Arjun Makajani, joins us. And joining me now is Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and, most recently, A World Without Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And tomorrow, the president is expected to announce a slight reduction in the U.S. footprint in Afghanistan, removal of, 10,000 troops. When we last spoke, Graham, you suggested that the real problem that the U.S. has both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and I suppose to the same extent in Iraq, is their very footprint is the problem.
Exactly. That may sound like an oversimplification, and it may be in some respects, but fundamentally, the American presence, I think, is the biggest source of Muslim anger, discontent, and the source of huge internal radicalization. So I don't see any turnaround. I mean, there are all kinds of problems in the area, but I don't see ultimately this problem being turned around until that U.S. Military footprint is gone.
And paradoxically, the footprint in Afghanistan, and of course the Afghan war, the logistics supply route is through Pakistan. And I take it that the collateral damage, if you will, of our presence in Afghanistan has been the destabilization of Pakistan, which, frankly, is a far more serious domino, if you will, isn't it?
Well, exactly, Ian, and that is my biggest concern. Of course, Afghanistan matters to some extent, but the major issue the U.S. has had there, namely the presence of al-Qaeda, seems to be considerably taken care of. It's never going to be permanently taken care of, no matter what. But yes, Pakistan is by far the more important country. It's population many times larger, geostrategically positioned, much more advanced, and of course, as everyone knows, possesses nuclear weapons. So that is what worries me. I see the United States essentially driving Pakistan every year into greater and greater position of extremes and exacerbating radicalism within the country that's become now exceptionally anti-American across the boards, including through the military. So I think the collapse total radicalization of Pakistan is a very grave threat that we are running and that I think the U.S. is helping bring about.
So in effect, the Pakistanis basically say they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the U.S. war on terror. And we tend to dismiss that and talk about their duplicity and how they sheltered bin Laden or who knows whether he was an ISI asset. And there are countless stories. And I've talked to a lot of people who feel that the Pakistanis are stabbing us in the back at every turn. You're, on the other hand, saying, no, we're the ones that are essentially destabilizing Pakistan.
Well, for one thing, the radicalization of Pakistan was not anything like this if we go back 10 years ago, there have always been certain sensitivities religious movements is strong in the country, but it was only with the Afghan war that suddenly you found radical movements with radical elements, including al-Qaeda, being pushed into the border areas over into Pakistan. But much more important, Ian, really, is that the fact is the element of Pashtuns and the Pashtun nationalists. The Pashtuns, of course, are the Taliban in Afghanistan, and most Taliban are Pashtun. But there are twice as many Pashtun who live just over the border in Pakistan. So anything that goes on relating to the Pashtuns within Afghanistan is immediately and directly reflected in Pakistan. Pakistan is essentially trying to keep the lid on in this very contentious, difficult border area, the Northwest Frontier, as it's called. And they've managed pretty well ever since the foundation of Pakistan. But with the failing U.S. efforts within Afghanistan itself, and the inability of the U.S. to deal with the Taliban within Afghanistan, we've essentially turned to the Pakistanis and said, it's your problem, you solve it, you have to put the screws on all of these people from your side. Now, Pakistan is going to have to live with Afghanistan no matter what. This is the only country on it's on the other side of its border. One side is India, this giant 800-pound gorilla, which is a threat to Pakistan. They feel they've got to have an Afghanistan that is in friendly hands. And because of the position of Pashtuns in Afghanistan, that their ability to get along with them, whether they're Taliban or not Taliban, is central. So that's where it really comes down to. Pakistan cannot afford to see a hostile anti-Pashtun regime in Afghanistan.
And essentially, you're saying that the delicate relationship they had with the Northwest Frontier, which was always somewhat unresolved, where we are the bull in the china shop there.
Well, that's exactly right, yes. And so we've seen extreme radicalization within Pakistan only since the Afghan war, and particularly since the U.S. began to put the screws onto Pakistan. So you find elements within, huge elements within the military who are very nationalist, and they are also Muslims. They see Islam as basically the founding ideology of Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan was created as a Muslim homeland out of refugees from India. So Muslim refugees from India. So, of course, Islam features highly in their own sense of nationalism and their identity. If the U.S. is essentially asking Pakistan to crack down on every single religious element that has essentially supported the Pakistani state in the past, then, of course, you're heading for a real problem. If there was no war in Afghanistan, this wouldn't be going on in Pakistan.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's station chief in Kabul, Afghanistan, and is the author of A World Without Islam. And let's turn, if we can, since the president is making this announcement about withdrawing some troops, not that many, but he is certainly losing congressional support on both the Democratic and the Republican side. But it's sort of more interesting in effect, isn't it, Graham Fuller, that the Republicans seem to be more and more turning against this war?
Well, this is what I find quite astonishing, and it's really just in the last month or so that you begin to see clear indications of this. I've puzzled for years why there has been no significant discussion within the United States at a time. You know, we have great debates about whether we can afford Social Security or can afford medical care for everybody, but nobody ever touched the sacred cow of military expenditures. I mean, as you know, the U.S. spends more on defense than all the rest of the world put together. So I'm delighted in the end that maybe now discussion is turning to examine the costs of these disastrous overseas wars that are highly expensive, bleeding is dry, and we're losing them all. So and making the problem worse. So any discussion that revolves around bringing U.S. troops back and demilitarizing our approach to the terrorist problem, I think is welcome and long overdue.
So do you think it could end up, ironically, and John Huntsman's just entered the race, although he may have a hard time getting the nomination because of the Tea Party controlling the primaries. If he were to get the nomination, I think he'd be a formidable challenge to the president. But essentially, the Democrats, unless they come up with a narrative here, they're going to look like idiots. They're the ones who inherited Republican wars, and then the Republicans turn around and become the anti-war party. You know, they're going to look really stupid, aren't they?
Very much so. I mean, it would be the supreme irony if that's happens, but I think it very much well could if it becomes a popular movement. Obama, I think, really only strengthened his presence in Afghanistan because he felt exposed in his strong opposition to the war in Iraq. He felt he couldn't be seemed to be a weak pussycat on both issues, so he chose to go after the more just, as he saw it, the more just war in Afghanistan. But that's not working, as we know, and I am surprised and basically, as I say, pleased that at last there's some examination of the war. It's not because it's a war. I mean, one can be more or less in favor of the use of military forces under certain circumstances, but when it's been used exceptionally badly and we're losing and making the situation worse, then it's time for Congress and everyone else. I'm sure Obama understands this, but he's been maneuvered into the position as commander in chief having to listen with some respect to the Pentagon wishes on this, and Pentagon basically doesn't like to back out of wars they haven't won.
Well, the treasure involved is breathtaking. The LA Times just broke a story the other day about how there's something like $6.6 billion, literally, that nobody can find from Iraq. And now the Iraqi government is saying, no, wait a minute, it's a whole lot more. And by the way, it was our money that was deposited abroad and came back as cash and disappeared. But as bad as that is, the amount of money that's been poured into Afghanistan is astonishing, given how poor that country is. If we would have flown over with C-130s and just dropped pallets of cash on these mud brick villages, we'd be better off because the nation building has not worked. I mean,
that's right. It has not worked, but partly because the nation building has been at gunpoint. And I find it sometimes astonishing that we Americans who fought a revolutionary war against occupation by our cousins, the British, find it very difficult to understand why other foreign countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., should be very hostile to foreign troops, foreign boots on their soil, which they view as occupation. So that's been the kiss of death to almost all reform programs there, and that's why I say it's not going to begin to start getting better until at the very first step, namely the removal of troops, takes place. Now, the obvious rejoinder to that is, well, isn't it going to be very chaotic if that happens and things could end up very messy? All I can say is they're already exceptionally messy, and if you accept the fact that foreign troops are radicalizing the population even more, you know, they're giving strength to the Taliban and other radical movements who say, look, we're here to fight this foreign occupation. And it's very hard for moderates to come out and fight that. They say, yeah, well, right, there are foreign occupation troops here. So I would like to undercut these radicals. They won't have much to talk about once the U.S. forces are gone. There will be a much more open political struggle and competition, I would argue.
Well, but a lot of analysts will go back to the status quo ante, where there'll be a civil war. I mean, a lot of people argue that it's already a surrogate war between India and Pakistan, and India has apparently put in investments, and I'm sure their intelligence people are in there. They've opened all kinds of consulates. Whatever the extent of India's meddling in Afghanistan, from the Pakistani side, it seems it's probably deeply exaggerated. So do you buy that notion that we're spectators?
Yes. I mean, there is a surrogate struggle competition going on in Afghanistan between Pakistan and Indian forces. But look, I mean, one of the reasons that we find the whole Kashmir issue also exacerbated at this point and radicalized is because of the presence of war and radical militias within Pakistan. Now, they've been, some of them have been there for quite some time, but the fact is their prominence and their role has gone up. I think once the area can begin to calm down, I do believe that the Indians and Pakistanis can ultimately begin to solve these things, but not in the hot breath of war, this cauldron that's just churning up, turning up the temperature all the way around on all political sides.
So would it therefore make more sense then that if the U.S. made a diplomatic effort to engage the neighbors, given the specter of a resumption of civil war, if there's a strategic vacuum there, if we just pull out? We, of course, don't want to talk to the Iranians, but they have interests there. Russia in the stands has interests. China has copper mines that the United States military are protecting. What an irony, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've got Pakistan, of course. So you would think that if you could engage the regional players in wanting to stabilize the place, it would make sense.
Well, certainly the region does not profit from this kind of polarization. I would argue that because of the military situation raging in Afghanistan next door and now flopping over the border, it means that what needs to take place is a demilitarization, essentially, of all of these problems. It doesn't mean that they're going to be easy or that everybody's going to start loving each other once military boots are removed. But it does mean that the competition can take place on a more political level when heads are going to be calmer. The Taliban will no longer be in a position to be fighting against the foreign occupation of Afghanistan as they see it. And I think there's much more room for agreement. I don't think India and Pakistan are going to fight to the death over Afghanistan at all. But given the war going on there, they've both moved in, for sure. But Pakistan will always be concerned that Afghanistan remain somewhat friendly to Pakistan because it's on their southern border. It's as if the U.S., you know, as if Canada were U.S. worst enemy. The U.S. would be extremely concerned that its relationships with Mexico at the same time be good.
I see. So you don't think it's inevitable that the Northern Alliance would reform and the Pashtuns would, there'd be that divide that we had before 9/11?
Yeah, I do think there will. I think that struggle will continue. It's sort of built into the situation, but there's been long conflict and competition between the Taliban elements and the non-Taliban elements within Afghanistan. What needs to happen is, as I say, for that to be moved away from the sort of war and terrorist means and to turn more towards political goals. And people who watch the Taliban within Afghanistan today acknowledge that there is a younger generation. They've learned something. I don't think they're still going to be lovable, cuddly people, but they're going to have a major voice in the country no matter what, once some settlement is reached. They're almost the majority of the population, not quite. So they have a stake in the future of that country. They have a stake in whether foreign countries can come in at their request to do the kind of construction work that is required as they wish it and not as imposed upon them by foreign forces at gunpoint. So I think we will see a slow change in the character and nature of politics within that country. And that it's going to be slow, but it's not going to happen until the war and boots, foreign boots on the ground in particular, are removed.
So we've lost the war, but that doesn't mean that we're going to have the short withdrawal of 10,000 that the president's going to announce tomorrow. But it will take a long time. And I guess given that we've already lost this war and we've lost the other one, your point is, Graham Fuller, that we should be really having a national debate about here is what are we doing with our military and why are we bankrupting our country and not even winning these wars? And since the evidence is so manifest, do you think this will happen?
I think it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a realization of the hideous cost of being the world's sole superpower and the world's sole policeman. I mean, I think, you know, we came out of the Cold War with that feeling that we were the world's sole superpower, and therefore it was going to be the American century coming up, if we can believe that, looking back. That's what we were talking about a decade ago.
Well, that's what the neocons tried to sell, didn't they? They said, now's our chance to strut our stuff because we control the world.
Well, exactly, but it's very costly, and basically foreign countries resent external intervention everywhere. And I think that's the first lesson to be drawn. We have to decide what is really absolutely vital to our interests. And just because a country is of concern to us doesn't mean that we have to be in a position to appoint its leadership. I mean, China is not what we exactly what we would like by way of a kind of government, but we know that it's a solidly ensconced government, and we're going to have to live with it and deal with it and work with it. This is going to be the future of the world. It's going to be multipolar. There are going to be checks and balances around the world so that any individual single country can do its bidding as it would wish. I would argue in the end that's probably a safer world than one in which one sole superpower, or even two superpowers, are duking it out for dominance.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm joined by Aziz Huq, who's a professor of law at the University of Chicago. He is a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and is the author of Unchecked and Unbalanced: Presidential Power in a Time of Terror. Aziz Huq has an op-ed in Monday's New York Times called Defend Muslims, Defend America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aziz Huq.
Hi, Ian. It's good to be back. Thank you.
And it is extremely puzzling to figure out this rash of Sharia laws. The very idea is so insulting, as though there's some incredible epidemic that some foreign power is going to infiltrate the America to the extent that they can actually change the laws of the land. It is such a ludicrous and racist and paranoid concept. But it's taking root, and I take it that having passed these laws in Oklahoma, the people that are propagating this nonsense are on a roll.
That's correct. There's an organization called Act for America that has been advocating for and encouraging state legislators to enact rules barring the recognition of Islamic religious law. A first wave of these proposals were introduced in state legislatures and in some cases on state constitutional amendment ballots in 2010. In one case, Oklahoma, the proposal passed. It passed in Oklahoma as a constitutional amendment, although it's now being litigated in federal court. And what we've seen since then is a larger wave of proposals at the state legislative level, almost 20 now, of where the proposal either singles out Islamic law or is written in broader terms concerning foreign or international law, but where the arguments that are made in the public domain and where the sponsors' essential concerns relate solely to Muslim law, Islamic law.
Well, Aziz Huq, it was bad enough that President George W. Bush elevated Osama bin Laden as an equal player on the world stage by comparing him to Hitler, and he required the full might of the United States military to finally smoke him out. But bin Laden is dead, and bin Laden is not running around the Midwest calling for Sharia law. I mean, where do they get this idea from? That somehow this foreign law is going to be imposed upon the heartland of America?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm not sure there is a good answer to the question. What we do know is that there was a spike in anti-Muslim feeling in the United States after the 2001 terrorist attacks. Now, that's probably predictable. What's less predictable is that while all of the indices that we have of anti-Muslim bias, so employment discrimination, hate crimes, survey evidence from nationwide surveys, all of those dip in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006. In the last couple of years, however, they have started to rise again sharply. You're starting to see a lot more employment discrimination, a lot more hate crimes, a lot more self-reporting of animus in national public opinion surveys. And it is against that context that these proposals arise. So it's not clear that the proposals are a response to some factual development on the ground. As you say, there's really no factual development that these proposals are responding to. There's no state that's about to adopt religious law, at least Islamic law. There's no state court or federal court that has to recognize or enforce a law or a rule chosen by a private party if that law or rule violates fundamental public policy, for example, if it's harmful to women or if it's misogynistic or in some way. So it's not the case that these proposals are responding to a real trend. They are responding to this shift, this upswing in negative public sentiment that we've seen over the last couple of years.
Well, Aziz Haq, I just was just critical of President Bush a moment ago because I think his foreign policy was catastrophic, both in Iraq and Afghanistan and in general. But he as a person wasn't prejudiced. He was quite sympathetic to emigration from Mexico, and he was also went out of his way after 9/11 to embrace Islamic leaders and to differentiate Osama bin Laden from Islam, even though, as I said, his basic impulse to elevate this guy was counterintuitive. But something has happened in the intervening years in terms of our political leadership, and I don't know that Obama is stepping up to the plate here, maybe because they accuse him of being a Muslim. He's sensitive about this. But, for example, the other night on the first of what will be, unfortunately, many Republican presidential candidate debates, this pizza fellow, he gets up there and was asked about why he would not have a Muslim in his cabinet. And he made the most ludicrous and racist remarks. And the thing that I found shameful was that none of these Republicans on stage had the dignity to challenge this overt racism from this obviously guy that was way above fighting way above his weight or below whatever the expression is. He shouldn't have been on the stage in the real world, but I guess he sold a lot of pizzas.
I think you're right to say, Ian, that there is a leadership vacuum on these issues. I think, as you say, President Bush can be criticized in many ways, but on the question of whether he believed that religious liberty was an interest or a value that all Americans, regardless of their faith, shared, I think there's no question that he not only personally believed that, but spoke to that question in ways that were effective and that had probably something of a disciplining effect on his party. People didn't want to step out of line from the views expressed by the chief executive. By contrast, it's not just that Obama hasn't spoken clearly to these issues. One might argue that his speech a couple of years ago in Cairo was an effort to speak to a Muslim audience, albeit one overseas. It's that he has affirmatively distanced himself from these issues. So no member of the Obama cabinet has visited a Muslim or Islamic religious center or institution in the tenure of his in his tenure in office. In the period of campaigning up to the 2008 election, it's a matter of public record that the Obama campaign took measures to ensure that Muslim contributors, even if they were bundlers, would not appear on a platform with President Obama. And one can understand these measures as responses to a fear on the president's political staff, or the then candidate's political staff, that these associations would taint Obama. But whatever the reason he might have had or has for those decisions, the fact is that they have left open a vacuum into which people with much more negative views of Muslims and Islam have stepped and have successfully dominated the discussion.
Again, I'm speaking with Aziz Hakis, professor of law at the University of Chicago. He wrote an op-ed in Monday's New York Times called Defend Muslims, Defend America. And I've always thought the as absurd as this war on terror is and has been, the only possible way that such a war could be won would be by nurturing and encouraging moderate Islam, because no Jew or Christian can convince a young Islamist who's about to take a radical turn not to go that way. The only hope that there is in reversing the radicalization of young Islamists comes from moderate Islam itself. And that's what we should be nurturing. We shouldn't be alienating these people. We shouldn't be discriminating against these people. It is so incredibly stupid.
I think that's absolutely right. And one might add to it that there's evidence that I and some colleagues have gathered that discrimination by both the police and by the general public has the predictable effect of dampening not just the kind of affirmative action that you've described, but also cooperation with the police in ordinary policing questions that may relate to terrorism. So people are, if they think that the police or the public are more biased, are less willing to come forward with information, are less willing to cooperate in general policing efforts when they concern terrorism, likely out of the fear that they're exposing themselves to negative treatment by the police. It stands to reason that if you believe that either society or the police are more biased, you would be more reticent. You would keep to yourself. You would try to minimize your exposure to harmful interactions. And one of the other interesting findings that I and my colleagues have identified is that it's not just minority groups who have this reaction. It turns out that if you look at the perceptions and responses of the majority group, so ordinary non-Muslim Americans, if they believe that Muslims or a minority group are being discriminated against, they also cooperate less with law enforcement. So there's a spillover effect from the negative treatment of a minority onto the behavior of the majority. And given the centrality, the pivotalness of cooperation by the public in counterterrorism efforts, right, despite what the government wants, it can't be everywhere all the time. This is an extraordinarily harmful phenomenon. It's something that tangibly creates security losses.
Well, but I take it, though, that this ban, to solve a mythical problem that doesn't exist, by banning something that doesn't exist, they actually has a negative effect, and it deprives Muslims of equal access to the laws. In your op-ed piece, you mentioned that in terms of, you know, butchers and bakers, etc. Can you explain that to the audience?
So these laws say that a court cannot look to a rule that is sourced in Islamic law. And as your listeners know, there's nothing on the statute books at either the state level or the federal level that does that. So the only instance in which that problem or that possibility might arise is when somebody writes a contract and in the contract refers to Islamic law, refers to Sharia law, and then goes into court to say, please enforce that contract. Well, when does that happen? It happens when people, for example, contract to obtain goods that comply with religious standards. So people enter into contracts to obtain kosher goods. They enter into contracts to obtain halal goods, which are goods that are compliant with Islamic religious law. It arises when people enter into what are called Sharia-compliant finance instruments. These are instruments that are structured so as not to pay interest, because interest is prohibited in Islam. It might happen also if somebody writes a personal instrument, a will or a trust document, that references some Islamic law doctrine. In all of these cases, it is very plausible to read the Oklahoma law and its ilk as directing the court to say, whatever the contracting parties may have written in their document, we cannot enforce these rules, therefore we cannot enforce your contract.
Well, can you imagine, though, anybody in this country seriously trying to ban kosher laws? It's unbelievable.
Can you imagine any political candidate saying what your Republican pizza vendor said about Muslims with respect to another ethnic group, about African Americans or Jews?
Right.
It's inconceivable.
I wouldn't have a Jew in my cabinet. Right.
And I think quite rightly that person would render themselves ineligible for public office by making a statement of that kind.
Right. Well, he's still out there. This goes right at the, not only is it an insult to America's core values, but it's such an obvious violation of the First Amendment. What's happening in terms of this being challenged? We've got a minute.
The Oklahoma law was challenged before it came into effect in federal court. A district court enjoined the application of the law, said that the law could not go into effect. That injunction has been challenged and is now being argued before the federal court for the Tenth Circuit.
Well, I thank you for joining us here and pointing this out to us, Aziz Haq.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me now is Arjan Makajani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He holds a PhD in engineering, specializing in nuclear fusion from the University of California at Berkeley. He has spent the last decades working to promote an economy based on completely renewable energy. His books include Nuclear Wastelands, Mending the Ozone Hole, and most recently, Carbon-Free and Nuclear-Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arjan Makajani.
Thank you very much for asking me.
And as we speak, Arjan, the floodwaters in the Missouri River continue to rise around two nuclear plants in Nebraska, the Fort Calhoun and the Cooper nuclear station. And they say they're designed for this kind of flood, but if you see pictures of them, they're completely surrounded. I mean, it's obviously there's been some concern in France when they had a dry summer that the rivers would dry up and there wouldn't be enough water to cool them. And this is the opposite problem, flooding. But after all, the Japanese plants were flooded by a tsunami too.
Yes, I think, you know, the flooding is obviously a concern. What happened in Japan is the emergency generators were flooded out and the diesel tanks were flooded out. And so they not only lost their off-site grid power, they also lost their on-site emergency generation capability after the tsunami, not immediately, but very soon. And they had only 4 hours of battery. The four to 8 hours of battery also applies to the United States. No nuclear power plant has a long enough emergency arrangement for loss of off-site power and emergency generators. Now, at Fort Calhoun, they did shut down the power plant some days ago and have put it in safe shutdown mode. And I think they've taken some sensible precautions of presumably learned from Fukushima, bringing additional emergency generation and making arrangements for a redundant offsite power supply. But it's not a good situation to have a flood over there. You can imagine the workers are stuck there. The roads appear to be cut off. The other powers, the Cooper Station, I don't think had been shut down as of yesterday. I don't know if they've shut it down today.
Well, the others, and apart from the what happened in Japan, which is still with us, by the way, those cores that melted down are still incredibly hot. And they're still requiring more and more water, and the seawater that they circulated over the cores has been storage, and now they're adding to it thousands of gallons of fresh water every day, and they're not quite sure how to tried to extract some of the radiation, and it was too high. So again, you led to this to the conclusion that we never got a straight story throughout the entire Japanese disaster, and we still aren't getting a straight story about exactly how much radiation has been released.
I agree with you. I think TEPCO revised its estimate recently, saying that the releases had been double what they initially said during the first week. But, you know, the Austrian Meteorological Organization, using measurements from the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaties Organizations Network, their estimate for the first week of releases is double TEPCO's most recent estimate, just for the first week. And releases are continuing to the air because they've got to vent the radioactive steam from all three reactors where the fuel rods have melted through the reactor vessel. And they've now got massive amounts of extremely contaminated water that they're not able to filter, and the ocean nearby is already pretty contaminated. So I think it will be a year before we see the end of the beginning, and then it will be the middle period, and we don't know how long that will go on. There's no easy solution in sight. And when nuclear reactors were built, first of all, no one thought there would be more than one reactor in trouble at a single site, and that accidents would go on for weeks, much less months. This was never foreseen. But there it is, looking at us in the face. And, you know, we've not only had floods, we've had immense, immense tornadoes. And I do not believe the NRC is properly attending to the Category 5 tornadoes with the Mark 1 designs, whose buildings were blown up by not very large amounts of hydrogen, it would appear, about a ton.
Again, I'm speaking with Arshan Makajani, who's the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Now, the other, I think, bombshell, if you will, in terms of nuclear power in this country is this investigative report by the Associated Press that took about a year, I believe, to put together, where the AP is reporting that the U.S. Nuclear regulators have working closely with the nuclear power industry in order to keep the nation's aging reactors operating within safety standards. What they do is they repeatedly weaken these standards in order to keep these aging reactors operating.
Yes, you know, in sports, this is known as moving the goalpost. And it's very appalling. This is really asking for trouble, especially as they are relicensing many of these very old plants for 20 years without a thorough shakedown, without shutting them down and going over every part. These reactors in question, many of them have had tritium leaks. They've got pipes buried under the reactor that are leaking. They've obviously got extensive corrosion. And we've had much more serious problems of extensive corrosion in the reactor vessel heads where the NRC has not been vigilant. We're a 3/8 of an inch away from major disaster in 2002 at the Davis-Bessey plant near Toledo, and the NRC doesn't seem to have learned much from that near disaster. I think we are really asking for trouble. During the Fukushima accident, 11 days into it, the NRC relicensed the Vermont Yankee plant, which is essentially the same design as the Fukushima Unit 1. and it did not even require dry storage of much of the spent fuel. And Vermont Yankee has more spent fuel in its one pool than all four stricken units at Fukushima put together.
And we know what happens if there's a breach of the pool and a leakage of water, that you immediately have fires, and there's far more radiation in those rods than there are in the core itself.
Yes, there's much more long-lived radiation. We didn't need Fukushima to tell us this. In 1997, Brookhaven National Lab did a study of a severe spent fuel pool accident in a densely populated area and concluded that we could have about 140,000 excess cancer deaths, and in today's dollars, about $700 billion with a B in property damages and in damages. So, but the NRC basically ignored this report, saying pool storage is quite safe, acceptably safe, and moved on. And since then has ignored reports of the National Academy saying dry storage is safer, a report in a peer-reviewed journal that said dry storage is safer. And the cost of this is miserably small, yet not ordering it. Industry shall make profit before safety.
So just though to get to the basic scary facts here, you've got the U.S. has got, I think, 23 of these reactors identical to the ones that melted down in Japan.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah, and that there's that they're all reaching their 40-year life cycle, but they're being relicensed to continue operating longer, even though there are leaks all over the place. And rather than force these utilities to be more vigilant and fix them, the NRC is basically deregulating its oversight.
Well, there's quite a lot of self-inspection that is allowed. So in that sense, there's a sort of de facto deregulation going on. But what is happening, I think, is worse. When you discover a problem and you have safety as your essential charter, and then you move the goalpost with a nuclear reactor, that's really an appalling thing to do. You cannot sort of be fooling yourself into thinking, oh, we built lots of conservatism, so it's okay to have a little less conservatism, because after these reactors are aged, you don't know how much residual conservatism is actually left unless you do thorough inspections, and they're relicensing these things without thorough inspections.
But isn't it true that the radiation makes the metal brittle as it ages?
Well, there is neutron damage, and there have been some evaluations of this, and I think some studies at least have shown that the neutron damage to the vessels is less than what had been thought 40 years ago. And I'm not saying, if you're a proponent of nuclear power, I'm not saying that you should never relicense these things. I personally think that we should phase them out, and we should phase them out in due course, and we should shut down the old designs as soon as feasible for the safety of the electric grid.
Well, but the Germans have bitten that bullet. Angela Merkel, and she's a big proponent of nuclear power, she announced just recently that they're going to phase them all out. And they have more depend upon them more than we do, although they've moved much more vigorously into wind energy.
Yes.
And the Italians are also getting rid of theirs.
This is something that we should be debating, but unfortunately are not. Just a couple of days after the start of Fukushima, President Obama announced that we were going to give more loan guarantees to nuclear power plants. I mean, we had not even begun to digest the scale of this disaster, which is obviously still unfolding. And I think these kinds of things are very rash and playing with public safety in a way that's really unacceptable. I can see there's a case for nuclear power as a low CO2, but there are lots of other low CO2 sources that we can do, and the Germans, obviously, they are going to become the world leaders in offshore wind energy. I have no question about that. They're already pretty much there. And, we're always talking about leadership, but we're not actually doing it. Nuclear power is a 20th century technology which makes plutonium just to boil water, and is very, very expensive on top of it. And I don't see what the attraction is of a technology that makes plutonium just to boil water.
So who was it that said it's a hell of a way to boil water?
I don't know. But I
thought
I
it was Einstein.
The same, same
thought,
much more politely.
No, but I know. I thought I thought was Einstein or somebody that
yes.
It was ascribed to. But again, thank you for joining us here, Arjun. And Arjun Makhachani is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He holds a PhD in engineering, specializing in nuclear fusion from the University of California, Berkeley. He spent the last decade working to promote an economy based on completely renewable energy. His books include Nuclear Wastelands, Mending the Ozone Hole, and most recently, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. You have been listening to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'll be back again. Bye for now.